When I came here, I knew no other language but Hebrew and Russian.
And Yiddish.
And Yiddish, which is, you know what Yiddish is? It's a jargon of the Jewish peoples of the world. They are not speaking Hebrew, but they are speaking a combined language of all the countries they have lived in. And that's called, properly, jargon. Yiddish is jargon, that's what I was speaking about. But when I came here, my husband was sick. He was a war veteran, he had a bullet sitting in his knee. And he couldn't work most of the time. He was in the hospital most of the time. I had a baby. And I never worked for a living before that. So to speak, in a factory or do some... You know, I used to embroider, used to sew for my sisters and brothers. I used to do house cleaning, used to bake bread with my mother, cookies and whatever.
But it was all like in the house?
It was all like in the family. You had to work, do that much work to keep the family alive. Keep the family fed, and I was helping mother.
Keep it organized.
Yeah.
Keep the family alive.
That's what I did. But when I came here, and here I found myself I have to pay rent, and I have to feed myself. And the baby needs things, and the husband is in the hospital. He needs to pay a medical bill sometime. Most of the time he was in the city hospital. And what do you use for money? That means I was the only one that was well to go out and earn some money. And on top of all this aggravating situation, I don't know the language. Everybody calls me a greenhorn. I want to speak an English word. Of course, I said it upside down. There was no question about it. I can understand it now. But I used to be terribly embarrassed. And I was saying to myself, I'll go on my hands and feet, I'll crawl, but I will learn the language. Because here I am in this country, and I've got to know English, I've got to know the language, I've got to know the country, I've got to know the history. And I'd leave my baby at night with an aunt of mine. She had a little candy store. I'd bring the baby and I'd put her under the counter to sleep on the pillow, and I went to school.
And you worked 9 hours then, and 10 hours a day.
I went after the day.
And on Saturday, you worked on Saturday.
I went to the whole day's work. I came home, I made supper, I put the baby to sleep. And 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday
That's
night,
what I, did too.
I went to night school to educate myself.
10 years I went.
It took me 6 years, and I have got a grade school certificate right here in my apartment that I made public school. I graduated public school course. I went 6 years at night to the same school to make a public school certificate that I graduated public school. And I learned to read, naturally. And since then, like Abby once told me, do you still like to read books? That's all I've been doing. I read. I bought myself an encyclopedia. I went to grade school, to grade books classes. I even went to college for American history in labor economics.
Roosevelt, we went.
I went to college.
We went to Roosevelt Labor School here for years.
So you went to school and you raised your child and you paid your hospital bills.
And I made a living.
I didn't have
any
living.
What were you doing at that time? How were you making the money?
Sewing. I learned to sew in the factory. I didn't know how to sew. But there
you had sewed at home. If you have one sewed.
Well, the primitive.
And you are gifted. Like we are. I am. You have to have an accent.
The primitive way of sewing in Europe does not compare here. I was afraid
no.
to go over to the electric machine.
But you knew how to pick up a needle.
I did not. And
you know how to get a garment together. I did.
So at the beginning, I sewed snaps for 2 years. I was sewing.
You were, because you were afraid to go to the machine? Or
I was afraid to go to the electric machine. I'll sew up my fingers. I didn't know what to do with it. So I was sewing hook and eyes and snaps for $15 a week. And on this we lived. My husband, my baby, myself, we paid rent Only they had one room for $9 a month. And after that, one day, a young woman that worked in the same factory where I was sewing snaps, she was telling me, "You're such a beautiful young woman. How can you sit there and sell snaps for so little money?" I says, "I don't know what else to do. I'm afraid to go over to the sewing machine." She says, "Baloney. You, and I don't know what to do." I say, I say to the girl, "I see you take a package, and it's got several pieces, and you sew it up, and it's a dress. I wouldn't know which belongs to what." She says, "Well, I'll tell you what to do. You go up to a factory that needs machine workers, operators. It needs operators. They usually would then got a sign near the building. You pick up a sign, you go up, and you tell them you're an operator." I said, "But I'm not." She says, "Tell them you're an operator."
I did, and I never thought of it.
And she says, "The poor lady will come over and give you a package of material, and she'll tell you to sew."
A string? I'm sewing a string.
Well, she says, "You watch what the other women do."
That's what I do.
And that so I was sitting there, and I was doing nothing. So the poor lady would come over to you, and she'd tell you, here, this. You fold it together. She says, "Well, you'll try to fold it together, you'll make a mistake, and they'll lay you off." That settles it. You go tomorrow, and you pick up another sign. You go up to a different place and tell them you know how. Already, you've been one day in the factory, you saw the machine runs. You saw other women don't sew up their fingers, they sew on the material. Why should you sew on the fingers? Sew on the material. Put the material in, whatever happens, happens. Let it run. And you learn to run the machine. And you know that's exactly what I did. For a couple of weeks, day after day, I went up to different places, and I told them I know how. The woman was quiet with me.
They wouldn't let you if you didn't.
And you know, 6 months later, after I started to work on the machine, I made $90 a week in 1925.
That's about what we were making then.
And a year and a half later, I came up to a place to work, and I worked 2.5 days, and I made $48. I told him it's not enough money for me, and I quit. I went up to a different place, and I made $110 in 5 days. And there was,
that's when you begin to
and
fight.
And there was chiffon dresses, chiffon
Chris,
material.
That's when you begin to learn to fight, you know, and you see the injustice, and you see this, and you see
you that. See, but I came up there to make a living, sure. I came up to make a living, but I was a sensitive person.
Me too.
And I was an open-minded person, and I was young. I began to realize, at that time when I came up to learn the trade, there was no unions.
I wouldn't hear it.
The union broke up in 1919 and 1920 in this country, and there's no union.
Well, yeah, they always lost the strike.
In New York didn't have no union.
1911, they had a union since 1900, but it didn't mean nothing until 1933 when the Wagner Act became.
Wait a minute. Now, then I began to make better wages, and I began to talk with other women that worked than men. And I began to find out that there used to be a union, and that there was a union in building, and there was a left-wing union in New York in 28, 27, 28, and 29.
I know all about it.
And I didn't know nothing about the union. I didn't, but they told me a strike. It's also strikes. I put on the big galoshes, and I walked around for 6, 7 weeks in the winter weather. Because the way everybody that worked with me told me to strike. I did not know from nothing. And then after I went through this, and you go through a little deprivation, you're deprived of weekly wages, you know, and you still have to pay your rent and your everything.
The landlord don't care.
And I made better money, I figured out, what is the good of me walking around the streets and not having another pair of galoshes? These galoshes are tearing. And then I took another job. Took another job, and I worked. I was still in New York till 1930. In 1930, I moved here because my parents lived here.
You moved here right before the big strike.
I moved here in 1930 and I went into...
33 was the big strike, but the one...
And so I just, wait a minute, I'm coming to it. In 1930 I came here and one of my brothers was a foreman at Pavin and Picker, the cotton dress factories. They had a factory 5 blocks long. And one of my brothers was a foreman there in the cutting department. So he took me in there because jobs were not very much available.
Oh, no, right after
times was after the Depression.
Yeah, right after the Depression.
So I came in there. Do you know that I worked there 45, 48, 52 hours a week for $14, $12 a week?
Mm-hmm.
They paid you so much per piece,
mm-hmm.
and this is what you made. But I had good experience already for almost 10 years of dressmaking. In the better line in New York, they always make a better line of clothes.
But you can get a job anywhere in New York.
The four ladies spotted me and she said she wants me to work on samples. So they gave me wages, $15 a week, and I was working on samples. And pretty soon she gave me 10 machines with 10 girls. And I was cutting up clothes of all kinds, culottes, cotton dresses, silk dresses. And I was giving out the work to all these people. I was the four ladies there. And you know how much I made? $18 a week. $15 wages and $3 overtime. I used to stay there 64, 65, 67 hours a week. I was the four ladies. Prepare everything after Dave and Avea. Eventually, I worked there for 2 years. Eventually, I saw these women, they just came in from the boat. Some of them couldn't speak a single word. German women, Hungarian women, they come right to Tavern and Picker factory. And I was the poor lady, they were European dressmakers, so they knew they would drop in on that shaft, you know. I see they don't stop for lunch. I was used to the city factories at lunch times, you know. Here they don't stop for lunch. I figured to myself, well, I'm a weekly worker for $15 a week. They used to make $4, $5, $6, $5.5 a week according to the pieces. And I'm the foreman, I can't say nothing. Then I said to myself, what in the heck why can't I say something? I'm the foreman, I give them 20 minutes for lunch or a half hour. So one nice day, I stopped the power. 12 o'clock. The forelady from the other end of the factory, the general forelady, comes running over to me. She says, what did you do, Rose? I says, well, these women are eating and they'll make spots on the clothes. What's the use? I say, I've been wanting to do it for a long time. They need 20 minutes for reading up.
Oh, they no stopping?
They nearly fired me from their job. But my brother came up, and the boss's brother was also in the carving department, and they talked to me. I says, I'm sorry, I've got to give them time for lunch because they spot up the clothes, and I have to use cleaner, and it takes me time. And I began giving them lunchtime, a half an hour. And they were so badly used to the slavery that one day, a woman was sitting, she was eating her lunch and she was running the machine. I said, I stopped the power. Why did you make it? She says, well, you know, they pay me for the pieces. If I don't work, I don't know. I said, you know what, I'm going to bring you a milk bottle so you can pee by the machine too. Well, I said it to her in Polish. Now that is true. And she looked at me, she was a Polish-speaking woman. I said, Russian and Polish. Or Slavish in Polish, kind of blend in. Mm-hmm. So that's what I told her. I'll bring your milk bottle and pee by the machine. So she looked at me and she looked at me, and I was so mad. I was red in the face because I took the red for stopping the power to give them time for lunch. And she sits there and she saw us because she's got to have a couple of more scenes. She wants to make a couple of more scenes. She's going to lose 3 pennies.
We still have to watch them from sewing it now.
And you know, I stayed there until the Union of the Ladies' Garments in Chicago organized. And I took my scissors and I came downtown and joined the strike. Then when...
33.
In 33, when they pulled the shops, I was the first one in there to sign, to register in the meeting hall. And that started the Chicago Union Pines working deal. And I worked here 29 years.
Yes, see, they had a national strike in 33 all over the country. The IRWU.
Yes.
New York, everybody was pulled out.
Yeah.
Because the Wagner Act was enacted, and it was legal then to organize. The unions were protected.
And the ladies' garment industry didn't have a union since 1919 to 1933.
They had a union, but it didn't mean nothing. It was only on paper. Since 1900, it was organized as a union, but it never was active until 33. And that's why they lost so many strikes. When they would get nerve enough to go out or something, they always lost, because the bosses were always protected.
That's when I became a union.
By the police, by everybody. That's what makes me mad today, when these police want people to support them. They're the dirtiest set of people there are, the police. If they weren't, they wouldn't be so much crime.
The police and the taxi drivers are hiding all the crime.
They hide, yes.
How does that relate specifically to what you were talking about in terms of the strike? Were there things going on there that make you say that?
In the strike? Why, sure. They protected the bosses. If you wanted to, if there was a rally or something, a meeting or something, before
they used to report them.
And they would beat you up, arrest you. The capitalistic system has laws for everything. They would arrest you for disturbing the peace. They'd arrest you for vagrancy. They would arrest you for obstruction, the sidewalks, or anything. There's laws on the on books for everything.
I'll have you know, one day.
And they get you on those things.
One day, I want you to know, one day a taxi driver participated on the picket line. And he brought a couple of girls. They were carrying a roller pin, what do you call it?
Rolling pin.
A rolling pin. They carried a rolling pin wrapped in newspapers. We saw the cab leaving out those two girls, and pretty soon those two girls came and they beat up the picket line on veils. And I was there.
People to do that.
And I was there in that group of the front ones were beaten up, and there was a policeman in the back of me. You know what he did? He came close to me, he says, "You're so little, use a ticket, go to the movies, go away, go to the movies." He gave me a ticket and I went to the movies. He pulled me out of there, I shouldn't get beaten up.
For sure, because TV's
the police,
they call them hoods or stooges or something, they called them, and they would hire it. Just like like Nixon hired these people as Democrats to go disturb the Republican meetings, and then he said they were the Democrats doing it, and they had hired these people to do that. You see, they hired people to do that.
In times of strikes, there was a lot of underhanded.
Oh, you have no idea, especially at that time.
What other kinds of things?
Well, you see, if you were picketing, they would just get people to go there and disturb the pickets or get your way, Like now they've made laws that only so many people can picket. Then they used to have the whole buildings were surrounded with pickets. But now they made laws, the Cathartian law, you can only have so many picketing at a time.
You can only walk
and
on the sidewalk.
See, the capitalistic system eventually makes laws to hinder the worker. They'll give you a little leeway, but not much, don't you see? To protect them, but they're always protected because they don't do nothing.
You see, what is a picket line? People, you're the boss. We are the people working for you.
Protesting.
We have new demands as a group of workers. We have demands. We want you to recognize the union. They want
us
to give us high wages. They want us to be, we had to fight for a 40-hour week. Later we fought for 35. Our week, which should be the ruling.
But
after, the bosses don't want to give in.
No.
So we go down the strike, we walk the streets, and in the back door, they bring in other people, they pay them double for temporary work.
To
produce their product. And we are outside fighting for rights.
You know what has been done?
This is what a strike is. You think a strike is only what you see the people walking?
And you know
there
what
are a lot of
do?
Things behind it. And a lot of bleeding.
Yes. And you know what they would do?
And blackmailing.
And you know what they would do? If they didn't have anybody in there to make you think the tickets on the outside that there was somebody in there, they would run the machines with nobody sitting in. To make you think there was people
in there. To make you
there.
Scared.
Think there were scabs in there, and you would get in because he had people watching.
And so finally, it takes being wrong.
Oh, you
have
no
strike.
Idea.
And this is not only in the nickel trade.
Oh,
the
no.
Truck drivers are facing the same thing.
Oh, yeah. Only it's not as violent as it used to be.
No, because unions,
many different laws.
See, more or less, unions are pretty fairly established. In
but you see what they
in many trades.
See, there's two ways of organizing a union.
As it was for the union.
See, there's two ways of organizing a union. You can organize a union by calling the people out and having picket lines or this and that. Well, that's organizing a union outside the shop. Then there's such a thing, which they do mostly now, is organize a union from within. The boss goes, the union officials go to the boss and ask, tell them to sign a contract. And if they don't sign a contract, well, they're going to have pickets out and they're going to boycott their products, you know, like this pants business that was boycotted for 2 years has finally won. And what blouse company was that? That just won a big strike. They wouldn't organize, and so then that's organized. Then the bosses will sign up, and then when the bosses sign up, then the union man comes in and tells the worker, "Well, the boss has signed up, so you all have to join the union." That's organizing within.
This is the union the union and the bosses' way of establishing unionism.
Yeah. One way is to have violence, the other way is
first
to go organize the boss.
They take one side on the carpet or to the table and sign with them, come to some understanding. Then they take the other side and they have an established organization.
You know what I tell Chris? Being she's so interested.
Yeah. Why don't you go in and work for a year in the trade?
It is unexplainable.
It is unexplainable.
It can't be. You have to feel it. You
have to live it.
You
have to live it.
You can come in there and look that over, and you got the people. You'd be surprised at
the characters you deal with.
We wouldn't want to know.
That's right.
When I was chair lady, she was working with me. There used to be a bunch in the corner sitting up there. There used to be. And one day, Mr. Rich told me, he says, "I still have friends out there." I said, "Well, the stooges been all over the world forever and ever, and they don't bother me." But one day, these girls, and I want to do something, I would have a grapevine going. But we never would tell this five or six girls, you know who they were up there in the corner, that they've been working there so many years. And one day one of them said to me, "You never tell us what you're going to do or what you want done." I said, "Well, I'll tell you, girls. I'll trust you one time. I'm going to tell you what we're going to do. We were going to have a topic." I said, and if they'd ever known I organized it, well, I could have got them sold out of union because that's in the Cat Party, though. But I said,
"Don't worry, Paul and me, we were thrown out of the union more than once. They wouldn't give us a job."
Yeah.
Because we were too strict.
I've been thrown
and
out.
Persecuting them, that they are just or unjust.
So then
we fought for the union.
So I told you, girls, I said, "All right, I'll tell you this one time. But if I ever catch you double-crossing me," I said, "God forbid," because I said, "There's more people for me than for you." And I told them what we were going to do. I don't know if you were there in there. Now, when we had that big stoppage.
And, was there long enough?
The assistant manager, but sometimes you go away, you know. The assistant manager come in, and I told the girls, "Right," I said, "just get at your machines. We couldn't get what we wanted. We were trying to settle prices. We couldn't get it." I said, "Just get at your machines." Well, they sat there and sit there. So then the boss, he calls up the union and tells them that we won't work.
Oh, of course, I remember the big
stoppage.
See, in the boss time, you couldn't make official stoppages.
Yes, so Star Flag.
You had to begin working.
Then
you fell off
the hours.
And you had to begin working before 24 hours.
Well, I'm
going to
get to that. So Star Flag come in. And he called me on the corner and he says, "Listen, you go around very quietly and you tell," there were 75 of them. He says, "You go around very quietly and you tell those girls to get back to work. Because," he said, "you know, we'll be sued by the union will sue us." I said, "They will?" I said, "The union." I said, "They will?" He says, "Yes, you go around there very quietly." So I went around very quietly and I said, "Every one of you get out of here. Get out of here." get out of here. And they said, where we go? I said, I don't care where you go, but get out of here. So out there, when I went on back and sat down to my machine, they were all going out. He called me and he says, well, what are they doing? I said, well, it looks like to me they're walking out. And that was on a Friday. So I went home, and he says, you come in here Monday morning, and you sit down to that machine, and you go to work. Because you are a representative of the union, and you've got to be in here and go to work.
Sure.
So I went home. I never left my house. I was either calling them, or I had all their phone numbers, and they were calling me. And you know what they wanted to do? They wanted to go down to Grant Park and have a meeting, and not even go to the union. I had them that much worked up. I said, well, we can't do that. We've got to go to the union because, I said, they'll call us a bunch of communists and they'll have the police
after us. And they won't
time
because
they'll have the police after us down there, 75 of us.
You couldn't make a profit.
Oh, they said, we never thought of that. I said, yes, but I did.
Oh,
I said,
the union, you want belongs to this maybe? I'll bring you a spoon. No.
The union belongs to us, and that building belongs to us, and that's where we're going. And everybody be there at 9 o'clock. So I was there first. And when I got there, this father had come to me and he said, I thought I told you to be in that shop working at that machine. I said, listen here.
Now listen,
Daddy. You said, yeah, he said, you're a union official and you get over there. I said, you listen to me. I'm pointing my finger. I said, I'm not representing you. I'm representing these people and I'm staying right here. I am not budging. And when they all got there, he got up there to make a speech, and they booed him and hollered, and so he had to leave, and he went upstairs and got the Alice, and the Alice, and somebody, Edna went and got the American newspaper was across the street, and she runs over there and gets a reporter. And the reporter come over and come, somebody says, go to her, to me. So I knew better than make a statement. So I said, well, I'll tell you what you do.